Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined in person.
You love us.
By Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward, and about like 50, 60 people live in our Reason DC HQ office thing that's new. And so welcome, everybody. And this is a bonus episode. Yeah. So for people listening at home or on your exercise bike or whatever, everybody in this room has been listening to bang up presentations on transportation policy and using psychedelics and downing chartreuse cocktails. So people are a little bit buzzed. So don't blame them, especially not the people who are on the microphone right now. The last presentation we had was about the podcast Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Eric Boehm. The beginning of this one might be considered to be somewhat of a continuation of that. In the following sense, we're in DC. One of the biggest things that changes about DC and about the federal government when there's a national election, most of the time it changes less than people think, but in one way it does change perhaps a little bit more than most people think, is in regulation and what happens in the administrative state and so forth. And one particular character of the Biden administration who is behaving in ways quite differently than what we saw in the Trump administration is Lina Khan, the head of the Federal Trade Commission, very active member of or head of the Federal Trade Commission, and someone who's been doing a lot of things of interest to many people probably in this room. So we're going to start off with Peter, who, if last I checked, lives in Washington, D.C., explaining a little bit, who is this person, Lina Khan? And you have, the rule is that you cannot reference any Star Trek movie, just out of the bat here. Who is this person?
I no longer, give me 5 minutes here to rewrite my answer.
Got to recalibrate. Who is she? Where does she come from?
This is SETI Alpha 5.
We didn't outfit these chairs with the buzzers that I had wanted. Who is she? Where does she come from? What is she doing on a macro level? And then afterwards, we might drill down into some individual cases. Peter Suderman, tell us.
So first of all, to everyone in this room, happy Saturday. Lina Khan is an activist ideologue who has sought to transform the FTC into a pure anti-corporate cudgel. Her main project is that she wants to change antitrust law. And what she wants to do is get rid of the idea that has underpinned antitrust law now for decades, which is known as the consumer welfare standard. The consumer welfare standard basically says that if the feds want to go after a company on antitrust grounds, they have to prove that the company is actually doing something bad for consumers. Lina Khan has a different theory. What she dislikes is just stuff that's big. That's kind of it. And the reason why she dislikes things that are big, why she thinks big things are bad, is because in her worldview, bigness in the private sector represents concentrated power. So I want you to think about this for just a minute. Bigness and concentrated power. You know what else is really big and has a lot of concentrated power? That's right, it's the federal government that she works for and represents now. And she's just totally blind to this. I think maybe even worse that she's totally blind to the idea that the federal government has a lot of power. It's that she is actively working to increase that power, not only for ideological reasons and sort of as an activist crusade, but she is doing so in ways that are at least dubiously ethical. So earlier this year, the FTC's lone remaining Republican commissioner, typically the FTC will have several Democratic commissioners and a couple of Republican commissioners, and it's more Democrats if it's a Democrat in the White House and more Republicans if it's a Republican in the White House. But the last one, the last Republican commissioner quit. And when this person quit, they wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal saying that it wasn't because Lina Khan was pursuing a novel, outdated, wrong theory of antitrust. No, that's okay. Actually, that's just sort of how commissions work. We're supposed to have different ideas about the law and how it's supposed to work. No, it's because she had a disregard for due process and the rule of law, and she was abusing government power. And this is Lina Khan in a nutshell. She wants to make the government bigger, and she's willing to abuse the power of her office in order to do that. And I think she is probably the single most anti-libertarian person in power in Washington today.
That's saying a lot. Manny Klausner, ladies and gentlemen, is right once again. Let's go to some of kind of greatest hits, greatest misses in Lena Khan's tenure. Catherine, why don't you lead us off with a test case?
First of all, I just want to say howdy to everyone here. And second, yeah, I obviously want to talk about a time that Lena Khan lost and her FTC got kind of pushed back. Y'all may not know, but I am now a fitness bro. I love to go to the gym and work out, which means that I am now keenly interested in the future of fitness app antitrust. And in particular, the even more dystopian future of VR fitness app antitrust. I don't know if y'all have tried the VR headsets. I personally cannot get them to fit on my enormous melon of a head, but I am assured that the ergonomics will improve. And they will probably improve in the hands of Meta, which, of course, is a large player in this space. Recently, the FTC tried to block an acquisition by Meta of an app, again, dystopianly called Within Unlimited. It was yoga or something, I think. Anyway, the allegation was that the folks at Meta were sort of too large, too powerful in this space, and therefore should not be allowed to acquire additional companies here. That was ultimately not allowed, so that Meta did acquire that app. But then later, in another fight with a separate app, we get this classic Baptist and bootlegger situation, right? So I have no doubt Lena Khan believes what she is doing. She is the Baptist. But the rhetoric, the kind of neo-Brandeisian rhetoric around antitrust, is now being wielded by anyone that wants to bring down Meta. It's too big, it's too powerful, and so folks who are suing them, folks who are in conflicts over contracts with them, use the same language that the true believers use, and they are clearly using it just for their own bottom line. Anyway, always delighted to see a Lena Khan defeat.
Nick, what's one case you've been paying attention
to?
Yeah,
thank you. It's also important to note that the FTC is, I mean, they're like the historical Philadelphia Phillies, 0 wins and 10,000 losses. But that's part of the strategy, is that the FTC can keep... Oh, there's a couple of Philadelphia fans back there. I'll speak slower. 0 wins and 10,000 losses. But the FTC, and this goes to Peter's point, they can just keep taking shots, and eventually they'll win a couple, and it has a chilling effect whether they win or not. But the one I also, just to... Lena Khan grew up on Long Island, and I like to think of her as a regulatory Billy Joel. And it's something that should be contained to Long Island, okay? But unfortunately has escaped the penal colony that is Long Island. So Activision was going to be bought by Microsoft. Activision, the game, gaming company, which has Call of Duty in particular, which is a very popular game. And they wanted to merge, kind of makes sense. Microsoft makes the Xbox, and for her, and her FTC, that was too much. And this is a merger that the Chinese government said, okay, we're good
red,
with that.
Chinese government.
Yeah, the red Chinese government. Saudi Arabia was like, yeah, okay, we're good with this. The EU was good with this, but it was no in the United States. They got an injunction against it, which ultimately was kicked out by a judge who said, this is ridiculous. There will be a trial later, but this is the kind of action that we have in our FTC right now. Before we go to Peter's example too, check out Profits of Regulation. Tom Hazlett hit me to this book years ago, came out in 1984, and it's a great book about four different regulators, including the person who is inspiring Lena Khan and other people who are hate big companies just because they're big, and that's Louis Brandeis. And we can maybe talk more about why what was called the curse of bigness is animating so much energy in D.C.
The other thing about the Activision suit is that one of the arguments the FTC made was, well, you know, if Microsoft acquires this games publisher that makes Call of Duty, which is a really popular game, then they might make it exclusive to the Xbox. So, among other things, Microsoft was like, no, we're not going to. They signed a bunch of contracts, like, making clear that they weren't going to. They said very, very publicly and also, like, you know, did this contractually
where it wasn't possible. They committed to a 10-year window where it would not be.
That is Sony PlayStation's entire strategy, is having a bunch of games that are exclusive to a console. And so it was like, that's just how this market competes already. That's how business is done in the video game world.
To go to Catherine's point, Sony is the bootlegger here. They're whispering in the ear of the government, like, oh my God, this, you know, they might take these games to be platform specific. And it's like, yeah.
Peter, do you have another example you want to chew on?
So one thing I didn't mention about Lena Khan is that she is young. She is just 34 years old, the same age as Taylor Swift, actually. And I do actually, I have like a bunch of thoughts about how Lena Khan would think about Taylor Swift, who is big, right? Who is just like hugely successful, has a monopoly on Taylor Swiftness in a way that I seems
although
very
actually
worrying to
she
me
doesn't,
as a, you
know, right? Because she had to re-record her album. So there's more competition for Taylor Swift than we might want.
But Lena Khan, the FTC Taylor's version.
Yeah. Oh. But Lena Khan rose to prominence when she was at Yale Law School, and she wrote a paper titled "Amazon's Antitrust Paradox," and it was specifically a case against Amazon, but also a sort of grand theory of revisiting antitrust and the way that the courts treat antitrust. But the kind of core argument that she made in this very long, very complex paper was that Amazon was engaged in something called predatory pricing. Now, what she meant by predatory pricing was Amazon's prices were too low. So low that they were seducing customers. Now, she admitted in this, okay, courts have basically said predatory pricing isn't really a thing. We're not gonna like allow this to go through. But she was like, but it should be that way. It really should be. So now she's head of the FTC not that many years later. And she has finally launched her big suit against Amazon. And the argument is that the prices are now too high. And so it is completely the opposite of the argument that she made that launched her to prominence and that probably, arguably, put her in the top job at the FTC. It's an incredibly weak case. There are just misunderstandings of kind of basic statistical findings in it. It's not at all convincing. And it is the exact opposite of the theory that she operated under before. And in a way that it is telling, because I think it signals that she just doesn't care what it takes to attack Amazon. All she cares about is Amazon is big, government should take it on and break it down, and that's it. And it doesn't matter what the evidence is or what the logic chain or what the legal arguments are.
You know, and she also, in that article, in the title, referencing the antitrust paradox, which was a famous book by Robert Bork, which kind of solidified the idea that consumer harm is the metric by which you judge a bad monopoly or somebody having too much market power where they're abusing customers. And that kind of linkage is pretty brilliant because everybody hates Robert Bork, right? Whatever he was before he was nominated for the Supreme Court, and his antitrust work is phenomenal. It's a great read. He became kind of a monstrous version of himself afterwards. So, you know, there's a really high level of kind of rhetorical sophistication, if not economic analysis at work here, which is one of the reasons why, you know, this stuff gains a lot of traction in public debate.
I mean, with Suderman's opening sort of remark slash joke and with the presence of the great American hero, Bob Poole, in this room and seeing his presentation this morning, it reminds you of what you've forgotten, but we wrote about a ton in the 1970s and afterwards, is that people then, economists then, were applying this kind of antitrust thought to government. That was part of the deregulation of airlines and other things that Reason's written about and got their beautiful fingerprints all over in those early days. And it just feels like that has vanished as a go-to thing for people who are talking about policy, to the extent that people even talk about policy anymore. And darn it, I lament that. That's too bad that it doesn't exist.
So shall we go back to talking about the Phillies?
No. What we should talk about, though, since I teed this off by saying this is a big difference between Republicans and Democrats lingering still, is I'm going to caveat that for just a half a second by saying this is a headline from a couple weeks ago in Compact Magazine. I don't know if we've got a lot of subscribers to Compact Magazine here, but it's becoming sort of the go-to journal of the new national conservatism, the sort of like trying to make policy arguments that derive from what they sort of understand as the Trumpist turn in the Republican Party. Here's the headline. Where is the Republicans, Lina Khan? They want Republicans to be doing what she's doing because they want to start using government to sort of engage in weaponized attacks, especially against big tech in ways that Robbie Suave was talking about earlier today, but against all manner of bigness itself. Donald Trump turned out to be a pretty deregulatory president. He made a bigger deal of that during his presidency than most people had a solid right to expect. He had a lot of solid people who were there advising him. He did, you know, press conferences where he was big pair of scissors and like a red tape on a stack of paper showing this. And he introduced some new regulatory rules, like two regulations out for one that comes in. So one could imagine, since he's the most likely Republican nominee by far, that having him in office would be a big difference at the FTC. However, let's remember also that he was rhetorically challenging a lot of mergers based on how he didn't like the people involved, like Jeff Bezos and Comcast and a bunch of other people, CNN too. And this is from the Competitive Enterprise Institute's 10,000 Commandments, which is must reading every year that they do. This is their assessment of Trump in 2020 during his last year in office. That's worth reading and keeping in mind as we think about a possibility of another Trump presidency, which Nick does every night before he goes to bed. So it says Trump's regulatory streamlining is being offset by his own favorable comments and explicit actions toward regulatory intervention in the following areas: antitrust intervention, financial regulation, hospital and pharmaceutical price transparency mandates and price controls, speech and social media regulation, tech regulation, digital taxes, bipartisan large-scale infrastructure spending with regulatory effects, trade restrictions, farming and agriculture subsidy with regulatory effect, telecommunications regulation, including for 5G infrastructure, personal liberties, health tracking, vaping, supplements, and firearms, industrial policy or market socialist funding mechanisms in scientific research.
Is that AI, it?
And welfare, almost, but yes.
Perhaps it would be easier to read what he left out.
That is also the case. All right, we're going to transition into a less controversial topic, which is presidential politics and Israel. Last week we had a Republican presidential debate. Let's applaud how many people watched it.
That was incredible. I'm so proud of you all. I hope you had a great night.
I gotta say, I watched it in New York in a bar with some of the listeners and readers to the, what's it called? I'm blanking on the
Dispatch.
Name. The Dispatch. And I have never seen a room of people more depressed this side than the Nader 2000 campaign watching party when they realized, uh-oh. Anyways, pretty sad goings. But we are in a kind of new era of the presidential campaign, in that on October 7th, there was a horrifying massacre by Hamas into Israel that puts a new kind of intensity, emotion having to do with the conduct of foreign policy. So I thought it'd be useful to tap into the big brains sitting up here to look at some of the existing presidential competitors through the lens of foreign policy, specifically having to do with the Mideast crisis and the upcoming thermonuclear war. So, Catherine, you are a lady. Why don't you tell us about Nikki Haley?
Yeah, I am on the record, I guess, both as a lady and also as having said some nice things about Nikki Haley on this podcast in the past. I still do appreciate her consistent principles on noting that both Democrats and the Trump administration spending went up catastrophically and there will be consequences for that. But it has always been clear that Nikki Haley just loves her some war. She just loves to do war. She has never met a war that she didn't like. She's often the grown-up in the room, but on that debate stage. But in D.C., one way of showing that you are a serious and sophisticated person is to say, "Welp, we have no choice but to be the moral compass of the entire globe and also the arsenal of the entire globe. So the only thing serious grown-ups can do is more wars." And in this case, you know, she, like many people, had sort of lumped together in a single question, you know, what to do in Ukraine as well as in the Mideast. And she just thinks it is the U.S.'s business, that it should always be the U.S.'s business. She says things over and over like, you know, the leader of the United States must be able to see the difference between good and evil. And by that, she also means dictate the difference between good and evil, decide for the globe who is in the right and who is in the wrong in any conflict. Of course, the zinger of the debate was the "you're Dick Cheney in 3-inch heels" line that was thrown at her, and she debated the height of the heels, but not the Dick Cheney part. "They're 5 inches. And? So she seems to be fine with being sort of aligned with the Dick Cheney camp of foreign policy. I don't know why she would be fine with that. It didn't go well.
Also, the 3-inch heels crack was aimed at Ron DeSantis, if we're being honest. Suderman, you're from Florida. Why don't you assess where Ron DeSantis is trying to fill in his own blanks with foreign policy after October 7th?
Yeah, so to prepare for this question, I went through every single Ron DeSantis foreign policy answer in the most recent debate. And he talked about a lot of different things. This is actually like the first hour plus of the debate. But I think you can distill his foreign policy sensibility down to a single quote. I want to be clear, I've not edited this in any way. There's no ellipsis in the middle of it. I'm not cutting anything out. It is just two sentences right next to each other. "We are not going to send your sons and daughters to Ukraine. I am going to send troops to our southern border." That's it. That's the Ron DeSantis foreign policy in a nutshell. He doesn't have a foreign policy. He doesn't have a grand theory or an ideology in the way that, say, Lina Khan has about antitrust. What he has is a collection of politically expedient positions that he has cobbled together in hopes that you don't notice that he has, that you don't notice that he doesn't really have any kind of big theory. And what he does is he wants to just sort of say that position and then get right to, "and we'll bomb Mexico." And if that doesn't work, then the next thing he wants to do is try to bring foreign policy into the culture war arena. And so a bunch of his answers, he actually talks about how, well, the big problem with China is that they're a cultural force. We need to be fighting them as a cultural force. When talking about Hamas and Israel, he talks about how he wants to revoke the visas of students who are supporting very bad organizations and bad ideas in a lot of cases, right? But he's translating all of this into the language that he speaks, which is, "Let's do this as a culture war, and let's bomb Mexico."
Nick, I'm going to ask you a question that I honestly have no idea the answer of, which I think speaks to a weirdness of our politics right now and the presidential race, which is to say, somehow, I don't pay any attention to Donald Trump. There's none, because, like, I don't know, everyone knows he's going to win. Most people are fatigued by him, or at least just sort of sporadically entertained by him, but not fixated on him as much. But what the hell has Donald Trump been saying about October 7th and foreign policy since then?
Yeah, I mean, Trump, unlike any of the other candidates, he has a track record in foreign policy as president. And he came into office when he was running in 2016. He said, you know, you don't have to drop bombs on everybody. Which was, wow, that's like a bold new take on foreign
and
policy.
And not only did he say that, he said that in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And that the Bushes
and,
sucked.
And, you know, one of the things, and at this point, I don't know if it's supporters or detractors say this about him, is he's the first president, basically going back to Reagan, who didn't start any new wars. Which
that's Grenada erasure, I think, or something?
Well, that's under Reagan. Yeah, or NHW. So in any case, but he did intensify many efforts, including in Yemen. I think what we're seeing with Trump, you know, he rejected, particularly when he was running against Hillary Clinton, who very much had a kind of a worldview, a worked out worldview of America, coming out of both her husband's kind of administration and then also the Obama administration, that the United States is the indispensable nation and that we need to be everywhere, always, all the time. And Trump doesn't believe that, but he does believe he is the indispensable human. And what he's been talking about is that if he was in office, Hamas never would have dared to slaughter Israelis. Ukraine, Putin would never have invaded Ukraine. There may be some truth to that, because he is kind of a crazy bastard, and that might hold people at bay. Having said that, though, part of the problem in the whole discussion of foreign policy is that we haven't, since George Bush, or actually since Dick Cheney, was running foreign policy, we haven't had a worked-out foreign policy. It was clear that America as an aggressive hegemon going in everywhere did not work, okay? You know, Iraq was a disaster for many reasons, which our grandchildren will only fully start to understand. Afghanistan was a failure, even as, you know, the goal of getting rid of Osama bin Laden and breaking the back of al-Qaeda, you know, is important and legitimate and right. But we, you know, we had... the neocon kind of hegemon model. Then under Obama, we had something different where he didn't want to admit that we were going to be bombing and intensifying wars all over the place. That didn't work. And then you get to Trump, where it's not about a theory or anything. And what we're witnessing now, and I don't think Biden has a fully worked out plan. He's better than Obama was, as you've talked a lot about, Matt. But, you know, we don't have a coherent foreign policy at all. And that is leading to a vacuum that is problematic. My concern about Trump is he thinks everything begins and ends with the U.S. And in fact, Israel has a right to go after Hamas. I'm worried that they haven't, you know, they haven't clarified what victory looks like in a way that doesn't mean a forever war, which is going to be problematic. But we need to stop thinking that the United States has to be everywhere all the time, and that any, you know, anytime somebody has a cold, it's because we sneezed.
I will also say there is a point for both parties in the primary debates when it becomes clear who on stage has any idea what they are talking about with respect to foreign policy.
In Vivek Ramaswamy's case, every time he opens his mouth, there's that point.
So, yeah, I would say...
So how many ships should our Navy have?
Oh, my God, name the ships. There are so many, you know, in this last debate, I think it was, you know, it was clear that Haley, of course, is a former ambassador to the UN, really does know her stuff. She really does understand the stakes. She really does understand what is going on in the world. And I think Chris Christie does as well, for all the good it'll do him. But that DeSantis and Scott and Ramaswamy are just kind of winging it, trying to make it fit into their own rubric. I will say, I always feel a deep sympathy for the people who don't know what's going on, because it is so easy to imagine, like, hey, who's the head of state of Tuvalu? Quick.
Yeah.
It's like, oh God, I don't know.
What's Tuvalu?
And it's, you know, is it even a state? You don't know. you know, there was who was the Uzbekistan moment a while back?
I mean,
right. So there's always a bunch of people who really would like to be president and who absolutely don't know anything about what is going on in the world.
That's
and
no
I think,
longer a disqualifier. Hugh Hewitt and Donald Trump prove that that no longer matters.
Right. So this is the temptation is to conflate knowing what is going on in the world with being a capable and principled leader of foreign policy. That is not always the case, but it sure would be more reassuring if there was at least a kind of, you know, are you smarter than a fifth grader level of knowledge.
So I tend to follow hopeless challenges, third parties, independents, and overwhelmed primary challengers in elections.
And the California Angels.
Yeah, that's a weird coincidence, all that. There is no Shohei Ohtani of American politics, sadly. No, and it's interesting to note that Joe Biden got a new challenger for president. Can anyone pick him out of a police lineup? I couldn't. He's a three-term congressman from Minnesota name, and I'm literally going to look at my notes to remember his name. He's so important. It's Dean Phillips. Yes, he's a distiller. He owned the Talenti, you ever get like the overpriced Talenti ice cream stuff? That was his stuff. It's pretty good, frankly. Anyways, he's a three-term congressman. He's running against Biden because Biden's too old. That's his whole selling proposition. He says that Biden is doing a spectacular job, but that he's too old and he's going to lose to Trump, and that's really not good. So he's running for president. I was looking just this morning, because that's how serious I am with all of this, at the people who evaluate his foreign policy. They can't find a daylight's worth of difference between him and Joe Biden, with one possible exception is that he's much more of a hawk on the border, or at least someone who's apt to criticize the Democrats and Biden in particular on the mess on the southern border and is making some kind of politics about that. He's Jewish, which is something that is relevant in the current times. He's a very strong believer in Israel's right to self-defense. He's in favor of a two-state solution. He rejects a ceasefire. So he's basically a little tiny Joe Biden. But what's interesting, I think, about this is that in the history of third-party challenges and of long-shot challenges, the modern history of it, who does well in those things? Like, when someone punches above their weight, even sort of in major party politics over the last 20 years, who does well? It's usually the anti-interventionists. Howard Dean, who wasn't anti-interventionist about all the other wars before the Iraq War, he favored all of them, but he was an early voice against the Iraq War and loud, and he, for a while, punched above his weight. Obama was hopelessly outnumbered against Hillary Clinton, but portrayed himself as the anti-war, anti-surveillance state guy, so much for that, and he punched above his weight. Donald Trump, in the context of the 2016 GOP debate, he was way more anti-interventionist than other people. Ron Paul came out of nowhere, and a whole movement that inspired little baby libertarians everywhere that we saw earlier also did. This year, there isn't anybody like that so far. The closest that you have to that is someone who's polling at 15% nationally still, which is RFK Jr. He thinks that we're the ones who are engaging, like who started the Ukraine war. So he's got some idiosyncratic takes on things. But he's also an Israel hawk. So a lot of anti-war libertarians are breaking up with him right now, when they should have broken up with him when he wanted to declare a death penalty on Cato and the CEI 10 years ago for various crimes against speech or something. But all of the people who were floated as possible last-ditch Hail Mary third-party people, including, God help us all, Mitt Romney and Joe Manchin, are thinking about a no-labels run. And so is Larry Hogan.
I am so excited.
Yeah, I know. We're going to talk about that on the Monday regular podcast, so we're going to try to keep Peter to contain his enthusiasm on stage here tonight. But Larry Hogan, his whole ad that he came out, I think, on the day of the GOP debate, and he's thinking about a no-labels run too, was that Joe Biden is not hawkish enough. So it's interesting that the anti-interventionist tendency in American political life, which is always there, and always is fertile ground for a challenge, at a time when everybody doesn't want the 2024 race to exist as it currently stands. Nobody wants Biden versus Trump, and that's what we're going to get unless they die, probably. It's really interesting that that anti-interventionist lane is empty so far, and we'll see who the Libertarian Party runs. Anyways, I talked too much. That wasn't on the ballot here.
You got feelings about these anti-interventionists.
I guess so.
None of us intervened because that's the popular position.
He lasted almost like 30 whole minutes without a dad joke, so that's pretty good. We wanted to tell you about, and hopefully when we get to the question time at the end of this podcast, maybe have your own nominations for an exciting project that we're going to come up with pretty soon here at Reason, and I'm going to let the boss lady tell us what that exciting project is.
So we recently came together, the whole Reason editorial staff, and saw each other in the flesh, because sometimes that's a good idea, and then we won't be doing that again for several years, because sometimes it's not a good idea. But one thing that we talked about is, how do we know when we've done something good? And so we had everybody bring ideas for what will eventually become a sequel to Choice, The Best of Reason, which was the Reason anthology that Nick put together. It's time for a new one because it's been a hot minute. So we asked everyone to bring their favorite Reason features, stories, videos from the last, I guess, when did Choice come out?
Yeah, about almost 20 years ago.
20 years.
Yeah.
So we wanted to share some of our top picks here.
Yes. So we all gave our nominations back then, but we're going to refresh them or change them as necessary, ad-libbing on stage, of one story a piece. And it's just also a chance to brag on our colleagues' great work over the last 20 years and familiarize some of you in case you they slipped through the cracks for you. But Nick, why don't you start us off with a piece that you think was emblematic or worthy of inclusion?
Yeah, I'll start off very quickly. And I asked when Matt said that when we were prepping for this, I said, we can't nominate ourselves, right? And he was like, God, no. So, but in that interest, Matt, your piece, The Profile of Lanny Friedlander, the founder of Reason, for the 50th anniversary issue is just fantastic. Catherine has a great piece about why plastic bags are good for us, which is phenomenal. And Peter wrote a profile of the Congressional Budget Office at a time when they were scoring Obamacare that had real impact even on the way that they process. So those are three excellent options. But I want to focus on Jim Epstein, who's the editor-in-chief or executive editor of Reason TV, our video guy. He wrote a series, or did a video series a few years ago from 2020 called Cypherpunks Write Code. And it's a four-part series, and we, in the anthology discussion, we were talking about, okay, can we figure out how to adapt some videos, because that's such a big part of what we do. But the Cypherpunks list was a listserv of people who Don Lavoie, the late lamented professor at George Mason University, called high-tech Hayekians. And these were people in the 80s and 90s who were imagining what the internet could look like. And they came up with all sorts of fascinating things. And it's this group of people who ended up influencing things like, or you see their influence in Bitcoin, WikiLeaks, the Tor, the Onion Router, BitTorrent, Silk Road, and other things. And why it's great is it's a recovery of a kind of alternative vision for the internet, even as it influenced what we have. But it also shows the libertarian roots, like what happens if you envision things from a decentralized position. And we need to, you know, go back to that moment before we take the internet for granted. We take the profusion and proliferation of sources and do-it-yourselfness and being able to pull in all sorts of information and create worlds in cyberspace that come back and actually change how we live. We take it for granted, but that's what they were doing. And we now are in a world where people hate big tech for the most part. This is one of the reasons why Lena Khan is able to say, oh, Amazon sucks, Facebook sucks, Microsoft sucks. You know, like, you know, people are in a funk. And this series reminds us of techno-optimism and of how, you know, when you take human ingenuity and then create the technology needed to create the world you want to live in, wonderful, beautiful things happen. So I like Cypherpunks Write Code.
Before I kick it over to Suderman, in the interest of completion of Nick's surprise bid there, I would throw in his great 10th anniversary of 9/11 piece about how art failed us after 9/11, which is an examination of all the various failures, novelistic especially after that, and then how, like, perhaps the best bit of art after 9/11 was a piece that wasn't about that, which was Man on Wire.
Suderman. So my pick is a 2017 feature story by Eric Boehm titled How Virginia's Hospital Licensing Laws Led to an Infant's Death, The Deadly Consequences of an Obscure Medical Licensing Law. So most of you in this room, I would bet, are probably familiar with Certificate of Need laws. Certificate of Need laws, or CON laws, basically allow local governments to control the supply of medical devices at medical facilities like hospitals, right? And so if you are a hospital and you want to expand your some sort of high-tech device or care system, right? Say an MRI machine or a neonatal intensive care unit, you want to build something new and be able to serve people better, you've got to go to what amounts to a local licensing board and ask permission. Now, that board is often either composed of or heavily influenced by other people who also work in the field, which is to say, your competitors. But it's this long bureaucratic process. It's a lot of paperwork. There's like court hearings and this stuff. I'm like bored just talking about this, honestly, but it's really important. And this is the problem that it often sort of pops up when you're doing kind of good, worthwhile, worthy policy journalism, is this stuff is boring. It's the story of bureaucracy and paperwork, which matters a lot and costs people and adds time and, you know, to doing things. But in this case, because it's medical equipment, it also has the potential to cost lives. And so what Eric did was he thought, well, you know, if we are right about this, if our theory of the case is correct, that this isn't just an added cost and a bunch of nonsense bureaucracy, then we should be able to find something that happened, a tragedy. We should be able to find a medical human cost as a result of these laws. And so he spent a huge amount of time in Virginia going through court records and basically found a story in which there was a hospital. It was the smaller hospital in a town with two hospitals. They wanted to build a neonatal intensive care unit. Their application was denied, even though almost all of the petition, the folks who sort of spoke up at the original hearing, almost all of them said, well, this is a great idea. We think this would be good for the community. Please build this. This would be wonderful. There was the larger hospital across town that said, actually, we think we can serve this community well. We don't need another neonatal intensive care unit in this town. So what happens is a couple of years later, of course, there's a woman who is pregnant, who has a crisis emergency event, shows up at the smaller of these hospitals that does not have the care unit. She's 24 weeks pregnant. She's had an incident that's basically going to cause her to deliver early and might kill both the child and the mother. And they want to get the mother and they want to get this patient across town. And they can't because the other hospital has control of the very special ambulance that you have to have with the special bassinet to run somebody like this across town to take care of a patient like this. And so they do what they can at the hospital. The mother survives and the baby does not. And Eric reported this story out and showed that there were real consequences to what is often seems like a very bureaucratic, very boring story about paperwork. And that, I think, shows the power of journalism, generally, to put a human face on these stories, but also something that reason, specifically, is very good at. We all love policy papers, and it's really important to have good work, you know, sort of a, like taking apart legislation and showing what it would do or what it has done, cost estimates, all of that stuff. But what journalism can do at its best, I think, is put a human face in it and real human consequences to some of these laws that might otherwise seem obscure or opaque or like they don't really matter to people's lives. And Eric did that story, did that tremendously in his story.
Catherine, Boss Lady, what's your pick?
I just want to say, as a footnote to Peter's excellent selection, this does lead to this sort of a horrifying moment where your reporter calls from on the road and says, I found the dead baby.
Oh, and God. You're kind of excited because you're it's like, oh, the story's going to, like, that's the story.
Glad he found the dead baby, and then horrified that you're glad that he found the dead baby. I want to talk about...
We were thrilled that we were able to expose that it was, in fact, a tragedy.
Yes. I want to talk about the work of Elizabeth Nolan Brown, and in particular, her recent cover story, The War on Sex Trafficking is the New War on Drugs. That story she wrote long before anyone else understood how important that beat was. This week, we actually expected to have a verdict in the Backpage case, which you may have been following in Reason, there's a straight line from that story to today. This is the case of a site that was facilitating consensual adult commercial transactions and wound up being accused of sex trafficking and also of sex trafficking of children. The founders of Backpage have suffered horribly. One of them has died in the course of the case.
Committed suicide a week before the trial was to be.
Pretty much as a direct result of the consequences of how horrible this trial has been. This is exactly the kind of thing that Liz saw coming when no one else saw it coming. I do think there will probably be a verdict next week. It was supposed to be this last week, but one of the jurors got COVID, and also the jury is wondering what to do if they can't agree. So I guess we'll see what happens in that case. But one thing that I think is underappreciated is that there's also a straight line from that story to Liz's most recent cover stories, which are about antitrust and about tech regulation. It is in fact true that the stories of that she was working on earlier in her career about the rights of sex workers are the same story as the age verification rules that we talked about on adult websites. They're the same story as all of the efforts by regulators and by congressmen to bust big tech. you know, we live online, and that includes having sex online. And Liz has followed that story all the way through. She is off on maternity leave right now, which is very inconvenient of her, as I have complained on this podcast before. How dare she? But you know, that long arc of that story, at least part of it, will be coming to a conclusion this week. It is a tragic story, and she saw that early on and covered it brilliantly for us.
I want to point out that Matt is the only one who brags about having sex online.
So my nomination.
Just move right through it. Just pretend it didn't happen.
It's fine. We'll fix it in post. My nomination is a piece that Jesse Walker, our books editor, wrote in 2009 called The Paranoid Center. Jesse has an idiosyncratic view and knowledge of history. He's written several books about it, and a delight in the paradoxes that arise in said history and the unusual combinations of people. In 2009, in the summer, there was an entire nationwide freakout. By nationwide, I mean in elite media, freakout about the existence of public protests against Obamacare, against big government, for the Tea Party, and there was a lot of shouty town halls. The Congress critters would go back home, and people would say, "Darn it, you're spending too much money," and people lost their minds writing about this. It's the politics of the jackboot. It's the thugs. The Nazis are here. They're violent. It's brown shirts. This was literally on a daily basis in 2009. Jesse looked at all this, wrote a piece that in such a way that you would never be able to see that same kind of story or the coverage thereof in the same way, called The Paranoid Center, saying, yes, there is this tendency in American history by the elites to look at the fringes and say, oh my God, they're coming for us. They're crazy. They're paranoid. Richard Hofstadter being the chief progenitor of this, when in fact the elites themselves, the center, the people in power, and what they do when they get paranoid about the fringes turns out to be a much more significant power dynamic and worth talking about in depth. His piece, which was great, ended up becoming kind of the basis of his book, The United States of Paranoia, which came out in 2013. But it's all great. All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena, since we are in this beautiful office in this not beautiful town of Washington, D.C. I thought that we would talk about pieces of art or whatever that have that either derive from or about in some way Washington, D.C. Peter, I understand that you live here. If we can make this a little bit quick, so semi-lightning round of what we would like to have consumed here. I mean,
no.
I'm saying this to Peter, you know, mostly, but
yes.
Let's start.
Yes. See. See.
The three best movies about Washington, D.C. are All the President's Men, Broadcast News, and Shattered Glass. And it is not an accident that all three of them are movies about journalists and journalism. And the one I want to talk about is the last one, Shattered Glass, because Shattered Glass is a great movie that is about how the best journalism isn't the sexy, thrilling, sort of headline-making journalism that makes you look really cool and sort of is impressive. Instead, it's about being kind of nerdy and kind of off-putting and following the truth wherever it might take you. Because it is a story about a young journalist who was kind of hot stuff. He was in his early 20s. He was a staff writer at the New Republic. He had freelance gigs writing for Rolling Stone and everywhere else. And he was just sort of, he was one of these guys who was like, oh, this is a young kid on the make. And it turned out that a lot of his stories were on the make in the sense that he was making them up. And it took his editor, an editor who was seen as kind of standoffish, as a little bit socially awkward, as somebody who wasn't maybe playing for the team, because Stephen Glass, the kid in the heart of this story, Stephen Glass was popular, and he was, you know, he played sort of false humble, but he always made himself the center of attention. And his editor was a guy named Charles Lane, who's now an opinion columnist at the Washington Post. And the movie just sort of slowly takes you through this. Oh, you can see how Stephen Glass is appealing, how he's exciting, how you might want to be around him. And he's telling all these crazy stories about kids doing nutty stuff at CPAC and about people who worship at the altar of Alan Greenspan and all this stuff that just, it, you know why it was exciting? Is because it wasn't true. And the thing that journalists have to do, and the thing that makes the best journalists, is that you pursue the truth, no matter where it takes you, no matter what else, you know, sort of even if it seems like it's against your own interests, even if it's against the grain, and even if everyone is telling you, hey, don't go there, this guy seems nice, he's our friend. No, actually the job is find out what's true and tell people about that no matter what. And it's a great movie about journalism and about the pursuit of truth.
I want to second that as a recommendation, but with the added twist of, and it is a great DC movie, but all of you should watch it because then you can feel glad that you are not giving your money and affection towards a magazine so full of itself, full of pompous late 90s, Clinton-esque, Aaron Sorkin-esque asses. You will be so glad that instead it's Catherine Mangu Ward is the object of your affection. That's right. Give her a round of applause. Nick, what's your DC Cab?
DC Cab with Mr. T. You know, that's pretty much history leads up to and away from that, man. That's when history ended. Now, I picked The Americans, the TV show that was on from 2013 to 2018. There's six seasons. It was originally on the FX network. I think it's either on Amazon or Netflix now. You can find it streaming, or Hulu. You know, they're all the same company. They're all owned by Gallo Brothers Wine. You know, but what is great? It's about two deep undercover Soviet agents who run a travel agency in Alexandria, I think, and they're pursuing the Soviet agenda against the backdrop of the Reagan years in D.C. And, it, you know, it's set here. There, you'll recognize a lot of locations and everything. But what's phenomenal about it is one of them in particular, and I won't give it all away if you haven't seen it, but one of them falls in love with America, not because of the politics, but in spite of D.C. being a swamp in politics, but kind of the promise of the United States. And at the same time, it explains why Soviets would have been dedicated to their system. It's a really profound meditation on the Cold War. And we finally have enough distance. I think this is one of the first kind of texts where we have enough distance to start it doesn't validate the Soviet Union at all in any way, shape, or form, but it helps explain the emotional and intellectual and political attachment to a system that was, you know, among the very worst things ever to be invented by humans. And it's beautiful, it's brilliant, it's nostalgic, it's sexy, dirty, smutty, political, I repeat myself. It's very good. And then I'll just also throw in for anybody who lives here, if you're looking for a novelist, which is, you know, Washington has not produced a lot of good novels, but Thomas Mallon is a local novelist, a literary novelist who has written a half dozen books about D.C. starting in the post-war era through the late Reagan years that are brilliant. But
Catherine.
You know, Peter always gets both the credit and the blame for being from D.C., but I am actually from here and therefore feel at least moderately qualified to say, you know, there are people who come here because they saw a D.C. on TV or in the movies. And a lot of those people saw West Wing and thought that that's what this city was like. Or maybe more recently, Madam Secretary, which has the same vibes of like, what if we all just walk around saying Wikipedia entries to each other and handling crises competently? That is not what this city is like, but neither is this city House of Cards. Neither is it the kind of like dark, you know, murdery, you know, we're not, almost never do I shove someone off of a subway platform to solve my political problems.
Well, the journalist who was shoved off the platform by the politician.
Who says but I identify with the journalist.
So the metro doesn't run regularly enough to kill people.
The series that correctly captures and embodies DC is in fact Veep, where everyone is kind of an idiot, sort of selfishly motivated, occasionally decent, and they just have no idea what is going on ever. In that way, DC is exactly like every other city, and at least sometimes you can get a laugh out of it.
So my DC TV show, it's not really a TV show about DC, but an episode of a great series that our own Debbie Gibbs over there was at least somewhat tangentially part of, called Sonic Highways. Dave Grohl's from the Foo Fighters. He'd done a movie in 2013, documentary called Sound City, about a famous recording studio in L.A. Sort of followed it up with a HBO limited run TV series where the gimmick was the Foo Fighters. You don't have to like Foo Fighters at all to like this series. They go to different cities, and that city, they'll usually visit a studio and try to record a song that's sort of inspired by it. And again, the songs aren't great, and that's not the point. But they end up doing a musical documentary about the kind of hidden history of the music scene in each city. So they go to Chicago, New Orleans, and Seattle, obviously, is a very poignant episode. But the D.C. episode is probably the best one because Grohl is from around here. So I think he's from Virginia, but definitely like grew up in the D.C. scene, in the punk rock scene. And so the two like subcultures that he gets into here are like super hardcore punk rock, Bad Brains, Crazy Guys, and then the go-go music scene, which is couldn't be more different. But then they sort of like find ways in which they meshed at least a couple of times. Interestingly, it's a terrific, terrific series. The editing budget there must have been incredible because, my God, they had a lot of material and didn't know what to do with it. But it ends up being really great, and it gives you a visceral sense. Even if you know a ton about music and a ton about music in DC, you will guarantee you will learn stuff and be delighted and go down rabbit holes. Thank you for everyone in this room for being here and asking us questions and laughing at Nick Gillespie, not with him but at him, and for supporting us through the years. Listeners at home, if you want to listen to all of our stuff, go to reason.com/podcast. The Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, the Soho Forum series with Gene Epstein, and etc. And then we'll see you in normal Monday times soon enough. Goodbye.
There's no such thing as a normal Monday.